This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to The Hub on Stage. On RN Summer, this is your chance to enjoy some of our favourite stories of the year. Today, you'll meet British comedian Bill Bailey and get your tongue around a tricky accent with Leif McPherson. But first, let's take a ride on the Deadwood stage. Yeehaw! The Deadwood stage is rolling into town with Calamity Jane riding shotgun. The 1953 Doris Day film. Oh, what a classic. In 1961, it was staged as a musical, and now in a whole new century, a small group of musical theatre lovers from Sydney are touring a new hit production of that musical right up and down the country. It stars Virginia Gay, who is fabulous as Calamity. It's directed by Richard Carroll. It's been a huge hit. It started life as a one-off event at the Hayes Theatre in Sydney as part of a program called Neglected Musicals, as Virginia Gay explains.
Yes, interestingly, Calamity Jane, although it's such a hit in the movie form, has never really had a successful professional production, certainly not in Australia. And so what we do is we take musicals that have been neglected for whatever reason, and we do a one day's rehearsal, and then we perform the show with book in hand. So it's very rough and ready. It's very, you get a real window into something very intimate. And Richard Carroll directed that. The cast were improvisers and cabaret stars, Sheridan Harbridge, Rob Johnson. And we thrive on a situation like that. We just discovered that there is this incredible heart in Calamity Jane. She's a real woman for our times. She's a woman who doesn't fit into any kind of prescriptive gender binary. She's a woman who has so much love to give, and society kind of shuffles her to the side. She's got this famous queer love story where Calamity falls in love with Katie Brown. This is a hugely important text for queer women. So we wanted, when we discovered that this production had more legs to it than just this book in hand reading, that's the kind of stories that we wanted to tell. We wanted to honour that secret queer love story, that secret love, if you will.
So the 1961 musical, which you re-performed, Book in Hand, not so long ago, that's pretty much the film on stage, is it? It's the same kind of story?
It is indeed. It's the film with some extra songs, because, of course, the film is a 90-minute perfect piece of I mean, that's exactly how long a film is, 90 minutes, and a stage show is 2.5 hours. So it's got some extra songs and some songs that Nigel, our amazing MD, arranged to make so complex and interesting and to sound of the time. Nigel came in on our first day of rehearsal and had arranged one of the songs to be a barbershop quartet. We worked really hard to make that, the very famous song, Black Hills of Dakota, we worked so hard to make that sound like an Appalachian folk song, like it would have sounded in Calamity Jane's time. Lots of close harmonies, like beautiful ringing out across the mountains.
As it happens, Nigel O'Brien is here with us. Nigel's sitting at the grand piano. Hi, Nigel.
I am indeed. Hello.
Just remind us of some of the songs we hear. Have you got them there under your fingers? Can you give us a little taste of some of the songs we hear in the show?
Well, we hear, of course, the Secret Love, which is, of course, one of Sammy Fain's most famous songs that he won his one of his two Academy Awards for Best Song for. So, and the old Whip Crack Away from Deadwood Stage, which is also another crowd favourite. Everyone loves singing along with that one.
Not a song with a subversive queer undertone, strangely, although,
well,
I mean...
Doesn't it?
Doesn't it? I mean...
Maybe it does.
Whip Crack Away. Let's move rapidly on. What about Windy City?
Yeah, Windy City, got to love that. We've given that one a bit of a... It has a bit of a ragtime twist, that one.
Oh, love the way you've turned that Steinway Grand into a pianola.
I've come in and detuned it, so they're gonna the ABC's gonna have me on toast.
Won't be you they have on toast, it'll be me they have on toast. You'll be out of the building. Now, Richard, remind us where this story takes place, because there will be people listening who don't know the whole Calamity Jane thing. So we're in Deadwood, South Dakota.
That's right. So Calamity Jane was a real person who was a sort of well-known figure in Deadwood in the territory of South Dakota. This is before it was a part of the United States. And this is the kind of classic Wild West time in the Wild West location. So she was an associate of Wild Bill Hickok, who's a big character in the musical as well, although she probably exaggerated her relationship with him. She was known as a teller of tall tales. But, you know, she really was this woman who was known as a sort of sharpshooter, tough talking, drinking, you know, very masculine character who, you know, didn't in any way behave or dress or act the way that society expected at the time. And she became notorious and sort of well-known and well-loved at the time. There was sort of like penny novels written about her, fictionalized versions of her, even within her lifetime. So that's how she sort of, that's her how her name got spread in the first place.
She has a slightly sadder story, though, it seems to me, Virginia, in real life.
Yes, she did. I mean, as everybody sort of did, she died quite early and she almost definitely, you know, suffered terrible abuses and probably, you know, was not as accepted by society as the wonderful Calamity Jane movie suggests. She said confidently that she was married to Wild Bill Hickok. Wild Bill, by this time, was dead for several years, so could not contest the story. And she, when she died, she demanded to be buried on top of him. Isn't that wonderful? Sources vary. Some say beside him, but I just live for on top of him. Like, what a final coup. Yeah. Like, no. This is where I want to be.
All right, now we're going to have a song. What are you going to perform for us, Nigel? Which song's this?
This is the famous Secret Love, so one of Sammy Fain's greatest tunes. So
I'd forgotten it won an Academy Award,
actually.
It did.
He won two Academy Awards for Best Song. So the other one was for Love is a Many Splendid Thing.
Wow.
So, yeah, he was nominated several times for Best Song for an Academy Award, and he won two, so that's pretty good.
Secret Love, such a classic, such a beautiful song.
Beautiful.
And has become such an important I mean, when we talk about the way that we're re-looking at the story, it's become such an important anthem for our queer community. I think it's really, it's wonderful to be able to sing it.
Here's Virginia Gay as Calamity Jane performing Secret Love.
Once I had a secret love who lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free. So I told a friendly star the way the dream often do, just how wonderful you are, why I'm so in love with you. Now I shout it from the highest hills, even told
Thank you. wasn't that fabulous? Virginia Gay as Calamity Jane performing Secret Love. Musical director Nigel Ubrien at the piano, and the director of the show, Richard Carroll, is with us as well. We're talking about the musical of Calamity Jane. What's the role of the audience in this? In this show,
we have audience members seated on stage. We have, depends on the venue, we have different amounts. We often have 30 or 40 audience members seated at chairs and tables on stage, and we perform the show around them and also in the stalls. We don't sort of respect the fourth wall in this production. So essentially, we have eight performers, and then the audience are our ensemble. So as you might expect, you know, it's set in the world of the Golden Garter Saloon, and you're all patrons in the saloon, and that means that you could be interacted with by any of the other characters at any point. We cast someone at the beginning of the show to play Joe the barman. We have this kind of little bit at the top of the show where we say we need an extra actor, and they're told that if they have a card put in front of them, they have to deliver the lines, and various other people in the audience just get involved spontaneously at different points in the show. So it's a very interactive experience, and it makes the sort of world of Deadwood come alive, basically, when you enter the theatre.
Richard, parts of the film do seem rather dated now, because as in all Westerns, there is a problem about the portrayal of Native Americans. Well, not in all Westerns, actually, some deal with it quite interestingly, but in this one, it is a problem. How have you addressed that?
Fortunately for us, that's more of an issue in the movie than it is in the stage adaptation. A lot of that stuff was removed for the stage adaptation, and I don't know whether that has to do with cultural sensitivities or it's actually might just be a logistical issue that, like I said, the musical takes place mainly in the Golden Garter Saloon for practical reasons, and so a lot of the kind of the fighting and the horse riding and the stuff out in the hills where that stuff comes in is either removed or just referred to. So that's a great start. And then there are the few little references and stuff that we just kind of adjusted or sort of snipped a little bit just to make sure that they weren't offensive in any way. I mean, it's obviously true that you know, the story takes place in the world of Deadwood, and that there were sort of battles between the residents of Deadwood and the Native Americans who live nearby. That's alluded to in the show, but we just made sure that we're not using any sort of offensive terms or saying anything that sort of others those people, and they're not the subject of this story, and so we don't want to sort of drag them in and be casually offensive to them.
Well, this has been a staggering success for you, because it opened at the Hayes Theatre, which, I don't know, seats 100 and something theatre, and now you're playing the biggest theatres that Australia has to offer. You're heading to the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne.
That's right.
Which from memory seats about 1,000 people.
Well, it does. We're actually going to reduce the capacity in order to keep the show intimate. So we're going to close off the balcony, and we're going to use sort of festoon lighting and various other decorations to bring in the show. We'll still have audience on stage. So we'll have a capacity of about 600 people at the Comedy. But one of the most exciting things for this is that every time we go to a new theatre, we adapt it to the space. So when we go into the Comedy, as we have with other Proscenium March venues, we very much adapt the venue to make sure that the audience get that same immersive experience. And so Melbourne has been so great for the show, and we're really excited to go back and do those seasons at the Comedy in January.
It's so much fun. It keeps you so sharp, Michael. I can't even tell you. Different, like properly different venue every week we were when we were touring. And we were like, this is so extraordinary to be able to, basically the first act is a farce. And often we would find ourselves pointing at one door, confidently thinking that a character is going to come in through one door, and they would properly be coming in through another one. And we'd be like, we are actually living a farce. It's extraordinary.
Well, everyone who's seen it, who talks to me about it, says, you've got to see this. It's just fabulous. So I can't wait. I'm terribly excited. Hey, thanks to all of you, all three of you, for coming in. And give us a little piano flourish there. Yeah. Nigel Ubrien playing us out there. He's the musical director of Calamity Jane. It stars Virginia Gay. It's directed by Richard Carroll. You met all three of them here on stage. And their season at the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne opens this New Year's Day. You'll find a link to more information on our website. On RN Summer, I'm Michael Cathcart. It was a total thrill to welcome the British comedian Bill Bailey to our studio earlier this year. I'm a big fan. Here he is on stage.
See, everything about European life suggests a much more laid-back lifestyle. Even things like sirens. You know, here are sirens very, very functional. And so it says, come on, come on, out of the way, out of the way. More than my job's worth. European sirens, a lot more lyrical, aren't they? It's like, yes, there is an accident, but let's enjoy the ride. In fact, the French ones are like this. That's just the bit you hear as it goes past. If you listen to it all down the street, it's like this.
He's a clever guy, isn't he? Bill Bailey. He joined us at the start of an enormous Australian tour of his show, The Earl of Whimsy. You probably know Bill from the popular TV panel shows QI and Would I Lie to You, or from that sitcom Black Books. But as you've heard, he's a fabulous musician. So when did that all begin?
Well, I started playing the piano when I was just a kid, really. I was 4 or 5 years old. And we had a piano in our lounge room in the house.
The way you do.
As you do. And upright in the corner was a kind of a feature of a lot of households then. Not so much these days, I don't think. And I just tinkered around on this piano. My mother was, she loved to sing. She loved to sing along to the songs on the radio. She encouraged me to play. And I very quickly realized I had a facility to pick out tunes on the radio and play them on the piano. So I had a sort of a way of absorbing music and tunes and remembering them and able to sort of play them.
And were you a kid who played at school? Did you entertain other kids when you were playing?
I certainly. I mean, when I learned the piano, I started to have lessons, more formal lessons, classical music. And then I would take part in concerts, school concerts. I taught myself a guitar and other instruments. And so it sort of started with that, really.
So you went from school onto the London College of Music. Did you intend to be a classical musician? Was that...
That was on the cards at one stage, yes. I actually thought that might be where I ended up, as a pianist or a piano teacher, or I'd be part of an ensemble. And I did it, I pursued it to quite a high level. I went to the sort of diploma level. And sort of where you have letters. So it's all quite...
Oh, you've got letters.
Serious. Oh, yeah.
And you're a man with letters.
I'm a man with letters.
Marvellous. I mean, we do know that you're a fantastic keyboard player. We see that in your shows, because you suddenly will launch into a bit of classical this or a bit of Bach. Anyone who watches you knows that you're good at it. Is there a moment when you discovered not only that you were good at playing the piano, but that you could amuse people when you were playing the piano?
Yes. I mean, I think that, I was lucky when I was a kid on the TV in the UK. There was quite a lot of musical comedy was around at that time. There was a fellow called Les Dawson, who was an accomplished pianist, as well as being an old-fashioned sort of northern club comic.
And he never smiled, but he always had a scowl on his face.
A scowl, and blimey, you know. And he had this very sort of lugubrious demeanor.
Lots of jokes about the wife.
Yes, that's right. The mother, when the mother-in-law's coming around, the mice throw themselves on the traps, you know. And he would have this great shtick, and he would play the piano, but he would play it deliberately badly, which has got a skill to that. And then there was the two Ronnies. They always have a big musical sketch in their show. Morecambe and Wise, a very famous double act. There was always a big song and dance number. So music was always part of comedy on TV, and it's what I grew up with. And there was a very famous, Victor Borge, who was one of my dad's favourites.
So he's a Danish-American pianist, classical pianist. Who just amused people by slamming the lid on his fingers.
Yeah. And that's right.
He would start playing Tchaikovsky and turn it into, some ditty from the...
Yes, exactly.
From the Top of the Pops.
And he had like a safety belt on his piano stool and all sorts of... And for me as a kid, it was just wonderful to see that. And it left a real deep impression on me.
Mm. I remember a Victor Borge joke about Bach. He'd say, "We're going to play Johann Sebastian Bach. He had no arms, no legs. He was just a bust." And if you've ever grown up in a house in which there was a little bust of Beethoven or Bach on the piano, you got the joke.
Yes.
I suppose a lot of other people are thinking, what the hell's he talking about? Chico Marx was another one too. That trick playing that he used to do.
Yeah.
From the TV show Would I Lie to You, we learn that you've got a little bit of Australia at home. You've got a cockatoo called Jacob.
Jacob, that's right. Yes. She's a rescue case. And actually, she came originally from PNG. She's a sulphur crested, but she's got the blue eye. So we wondered whether that was an Australian cockatoo
And in fact, it turns out she was actually she's a cockatoo called a triton. And they differ from the Australian ones because the Australian self-accresteds have just got white around the eye. But she's got this beautiful powder blue. So it turns out she's a subspecies of the Australian one. It's called a triton and found in Papua New Guinea and West Papua. She'd been a pet, and then the owners, for whatever reason, couldn't look after her, so we took her on as part of our menagerie. So she's now part of our gang.
So you have a vast menagerie.
Well, we've got quite a few animals. Yeah, I mean, it started out as a sort of, you know, looking after the odd rescue dog and the odd waifs and stray, and it sort of built up from there. So we now have quite a lot of animals, a lot of enclosures, a lot of space we've given over for looking after animals in strife.
And I gather that you nearly came to grief rescuing a goose.
Yeah, well, that's right. This happened on Valentine's night of all nights, when my wife and I had been out for dinner and we were driving back through London, and we sometimes, just for, you know, because we liked the road, we used to drive down the Mall in front of Buckingham Palace. And you could drive around it, and that would take us to West London. Anyway, we noticed something in the road. It was a large bird, which turns out to be a goose, that had been hit by a car and was injured. But it was still alive, and the wing was flapping. And so we stopped. And anyway, if this had been anywhere else, we'd have just stopped. And what we did was we had a blanket in the back of the car. We got the goose in the blanket, put it in the back of the car, and we were going to take it to an animal hospital nearby. But of course, it's outside Buckingham Palace. This place is, as we then found out, obviously absolutely crawling with special branch, you know, plainclothes, royal protection squad, armed officers who are there primed, ready to respond to anything suspicious within minutes. And so what seemed like within seconds, as we got the goose from the road and we're wrestling this thing in. I mean, it looked dodgy, I have to say. It was dark. It looked like we were kidnapping something and put it in the back of the car. These guys just came out just out of nowhere. And they had pistols, handguns, holding, and then they held the gun at me and said, "What are you doing?" And it was a bit intimidating, I have to say, because you know, I wasn't expecting it. And obviously I was a little bit tongue-tied. So I just kept saying, a goose.
A likely story.
Yeah, and he went, yeah, right. And I said, "It's a goose. We've got a goose." And so the goose was under the blanket. And so I said, "No, there's a goose in the car." And so we pulled the blanket back, and the goose's head reared up and looked at the guy with his partner, who then, which I thought was a little bit, it was hilarious, he pointed the gun at the goose. he's going to take it out. Like, this is a sort of, you know, an agent of a foreign power. And then he did that thing with the radio, you know, yeah. You know, "Stand down." He actually said, "Stand down, it's a goose." And I don't know what would have happened if we'd not told them it was a goose. Yeah. I had this terrible, I mean, for a long time, I thought, you know, perhaps we could have come to grief.
So you're in Australia with a show called The Earl of Whimsy.
Yes.
Which is a lovely word, whimsy.
Whimsy, yeah.
What does whimsy
I've always loved it. It's kind of, you know, light-hearted entertainment, it can be all sorts of things. It's a tangential idea. It can be a fanciful notion. It can be, it encompasses a lot of the things which are actually in the show. And it seemed like an appropriate name. I get called lots of different sorts of names and people, you know, papers, journalists. I get all kinds of, you know, usually connected to Middle Earth or some sort of, you know, Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, elf, orc, whatever. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to actually preempt what I get called and think up my own name for myself. And this is partly because this show is very much a bit, it just follows a lot of the trains of thought that I have, which often go off in lots of different directions. I think, you know, there's music in there, there's the history of jokes and comedy, there's a bit of politics, there's a bit of poetry, my own travel stories, where comedy's taken me over the years. So it's really everything is, you know, all the things that interest me.
And Shakespeare makes an appearance, Shakespeare's contribution to comedy?
Yes, indeed. Just the language, the way that the words are filtered into modern life, you know, tradition, certain joke formats, like the knock-knock joke, has its roots in that era. You know, it's sort
well,
of,
you know, yeah. Hamlet yeah. starts with the words, "Who's there?" Yeah. Those are the first two words. In fact,
yeah.
when I go to Hamlet, I have a little temptation to watch the guard who's terrified on the battlements of Elsinore with his sword out yeah. because they've seen a ghost on a previous night, and also they're being invaded by a foreign power. And the moment he takes that breath to say, "Who's there?" I want to shout from the audience, "Knock, knock!"
No, yeah.
So he just go, "Who's there?" Yeah,
that's right. You start with a gag. Yeah. That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
how, apart from that little dimension of yeah. Hamlet, how is Shakespeare linked to the knock, knock joke?
Well, one of the first appearances of the whole format, the kind of the call and response thing, which you know, is the essence of what it is, it happens in Macbeth. And it happens in the porter scene, when he's sort of, you know, he says, "Oh, knock, knock, who's there in the name of Beelzebub?" And so he sort of acts out this little scene where he pretends to be not only the person behind the door, but the person who's knocking on the door. You read it, you think, this is the earliest kind of form. This is almost like the birth of the knock, knock joke, of how he pretends to be both the person, knock, knock, who's there, and he answers himself. It fascinates me because I think this is something we take for granted. It's become part of our culture. Christmas, it's a tradition. We pull crackers, and there's a hat in there and a little gift, a trinket, and a knock, knock joke.
Yeah.
The whole call and response thing happened much later. The sort of the joke, the format that we know about it, where you say, so-and-so, who, and then there comes the punchline. It never used to be that. It never used to be like that. It was always just like, I don't know, just a little role-playing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, British theatre, popular theatre is full of call and response, isn't it? All that sort of yeah. look behind you and, oh, yes, yeah. it is. Oh, panto. No, it yeah, isn't. All absolutely. That panto stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basic.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bill Bailey, he's a wonderfully playful keyboard player. There are a lot of clips of him doing his thing on YouTube. He's just a very funny man.
You're listening to The Hub.
On Stage.
With Michael Cathcart.
Now, imagine that you're an actor and you have to play Calamity Jane or a Scottish person or a really posh English person and you just can't get the hang of the accent. Instead of liberating your character, the accent is holding you back. Well, maybe you need a few sessions with one of the country's best-known voice and dialect coaches, Leith McPherson. So what does a voice coach do?
This is what I'm asked at customs all the time. What dialect coach? Explain yourself. I work with actors to really build a character's voice. So from the ground up, you're trying to help the actor to embody a character, which is often an act of transformation. So you're getting them to move from whatever their home accent might be to an accent that could be similar but different for the character or significantly different for the writing and the story.
So you're also a senior lecturer in theatre at the Victorian College of the Arts. So you're moulding young actors and helping them use their voices more effectively as well as doing the accent thing?
I'm trying to change the world, actually, Michael.
Yeah,
I think that in this country we don't really value voice work in the way that some other cultures do. And so I'm at the coalface trying to build the industry I then like to work in.
I think we mistrust voice work, actually. I mean, I've been involved in theatre one way and another since the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And we used to talk disparagingly about the theatre of beautiful speaking as though there was something phony about walking to the front of the stage and speaking into the blackness in a way that was powerful and poetic and hypnotic. We mistrusted that because it seemed somehow fake.
The thing about performance is that it will always be a performative kind of energy. As soon as someone gets on stage, they are different. No matter how naturalistic their acting might be, they are no longer the person in the street. By definition, you are sharing a story with a large group of people, and that will change the way that you use your voice to get to the back of the hall,
yeah.
to get to the person in row double Q. That act in and of itself is going to shift the way that people speak.
The challenge for an actor, I guess, is how do you find nuance and subtlety and intimacy and authenticity if you're supposed to talk loud all the time? That must be the question boldly stated.
And that's the skill. So that's why it takes training. That's why it does take that build up of understanding that once you find an internal truth, if that's the way that the actor is working, of finding a connection to character, that you then have the confidence and also the physical ability to take that. I'm getting a little bit louder as I demonstrate this, but to actually take that to a horizon that continues to shift. And so that is a skill. It's something that you can learn. It's something that actors do learn. And I remember, for example, when I first moved to London 20 years ago and I saw Dame Judi Dench in a show, and I was in the nosebleed seats. I was a million miles from her down on the stage, looking down at what felt like a sort of 50-degree angle. And yet I felt she was talking to me. Her skill, her generosity, her awareness of the space, both vocally, physically, and with eyeline, just made everyone in the space feel included. And actors who have had a lot of experience with that, it becomes their new default setting. It becomes the way that they think of performance and how to use their voices. I think the issue these days is that a lot of directors and a lot of companies don't trust that process. And we're so used to hearing amplified voices that these days everyone just gets mic'd. You stick someone in the Rospacker Theatre in Sydney and everyone gets mic'd to fill that space. So audiences and actors don't get used to the shared, naturally amplified voice. They're only used to things that come through the speakers, which I think is a tragedy, but don't get me started.
It's interesting that opera singers, on the other hand, are determined not to be mic'd. They really hate being mic'd because they regard it as part of their craft to hit that back wall.
Absolutely. And I feel like that expectation is shifting, but it still needs to be part of the actor's craft. You should always have the sense of sharing the space, because otherwise it's not just that the voice diminishes, but the performances diminish. They become filmic. The actors will work for the distance between themselves and their fellow actors on stage. They're not thinking about the person who's at the back of the theatre because they know they don't need to project to them. So, issues.
Well, one of the marvellous jobs you've done in your life is you've helped the actors in Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy to get their mouths around the accents of, well, that world of Middle-earth and all the other realms and kingdoms and so on. So talk me through that. How do you get the cast to speak as though they sound as though they belong in a Tolkien story?
You get a certain degree of license with something like that because it is a fantastical world. So that's a nice little buffer to have, that you're not trying to say this person is definitely from Leeds and this is a Leeds accent and we will rise or fall by that authenticity. You're trying to create a vocal landscape. You're trying to, in the case of The Hobbit, identify different family groups or different kinds of races within that world. So there are elves and orcs and hobbits and all sorts of, and wizards and all kinds.
So how does
creatures.
An elf talk?
All of the elves speak with an RP accent, which is a term that means received pronunciation. So it's an accent that some people might call Queen's English or Standard British or BBC English. And it's got associations culturally, internationally, across the world with people who are, well, either villains in a lot of American movies or people who are educated or have a high social standing. So when you're playing a noble character like an elf, a learned character like an elf who's lived for hundreds of years, that was an accent that naturally lends itself to the audience's association with those traits. So RP is the accent that you would use.
Right. I think you just sound cleverer if you can speak with that kind of accent.
Well, I would certainly debate that, but I do whether you are cleverer.
No, I didn't say you are clever.
No, indeed.
I said one sounds
exactly
cleverer.
There's a definite cultural shorthand as soon as you start to go into that accent. People have associations with it, the kinds of people they've heard speak with that accent before, and they start to make that association with the character that you're seeing on screen or hearing on screen.
Yes. So, okay, so that's the sort of posh accent that we find in the Tolkien cosmos. Yeah. What other accents were there?
Well, there's a character who wasn't actually in The Hobbit, but was in the Lord of the Rings trilogy called Samwise Gamgee, who's a hobbit, which is one of the races of Middle-earth, a gardener, a very sort of salt of the earth type. And that was like going into something like a West Country sort of accent where you've got a bit of that kind of quality where it's really sort of sing-song and it has like associations with people who are a little bit sort of, you know, more less posh and kind of, you know, grounded and sort of, you know, kind of say what they mean and mean what they say. And I don't want to say they're a bit simpler, but that is for a character who is intended to not be a sort of noble hero, but is like the person that you root for, that you really want to succeed, heart of gold, then you might have an accent like that. That is a not an uncommon choice.
And I suppose the challenge is to get the character to see the world from that side of the fence, because it's easy to see that accent from a kind of London BBC point of view as a kind of amusing person from the provinces.
Oh, I have big issues, but yes, absolutely. There were characters in The Hobbit who, you know, like might have a northern accent, so they're going for something which is intended to be like they're a bit more direct and they've got that kind of no-nonsense, you know, grounded sort of thing going on, where you have that feeling like you're not posh, you're straight up, you just got that kind of state it the way it is, and just be direct with people and don't take yourself too seriously, that kind of accent, which is something that we played with as well.
Right. So if you're coaching someone in that accent, let's take that accent there. Yeah. Do you start with certain sounds that are kind of markers of that accent?
Yeah. When you're first working with an actor, they can feel, depending on how far they have to shift, they can feel like it's just a wall of different sounds. And so you need to help their brain to do what their brain is built to do, which is to recognize patterns and then to start to identify that, although it can be a big number of changes that you're doing, they can be quite consistent as you go through a text. And with actors, you're always working with prescribed text. They know what they're saying before they say it. So you can then start to break down those rules and help them to shift the vowel sounds, shift the consonant sound, then start to piece that together with the tune of the accent, then put that into something that is embodied. So right. You never want someone to sound, with any theatre work I do or film work that I do, you don't want people to come away saying, what a great accent. You want them to have focused on the story. So the actor then needs to make sure that they are finding that in their voice and they're applying that to the story that they want to tell. What are they saying about the character with that accent?
So let's take that. On the wall behind you, there's a sign that says, listen, hear the world differently.
Yes.
So suppose we stick with that northern accent. How would I say that so I sounded like I was a cricketer from Yorkshire?
Listen. So I'd start you by talking about something called the dark L. And the dark L sound is where you've got the back of your tongue up. So it's like it's filling your mouth. So if we do, in Australian, we do a light L and a dark L. And a light L is where you put the tip of your tongue and what's called your alveolar ridge, which is just up and behind your upper teeth. So if you take the tip of your tongue, listeners, to your upper back teeth, and then the back of your upper teeth, and then take it around that little corner that you'll feel behind your front teeth, and you'll feel a little ridgy bit. That's called your alveolar ridge. And when we do what's called a light L, we have the tip of our tongue on that spot and we have the back of our tongue down. So if you're saying a word like my name, Leith, you're going to have the tip of your tongue on your alveolar ridge and the back of your tongue down. But if we're going for a northern accent, I'm going to go for a dark L with that. So it's going to have the back of your tongue up. So it's going to be Leith.
The word is listen. Let's go with listen.
So do that all, like you're filling your mouth with your tongue. Listen.
Listen.
Yeah, listen. And then you'd say, hear the world differently. So hear the world differently.
Hear the world.
World differently. So we're not doing anything with the R there. We're not going for like world. We'll do that for Scots.
Right.
But here it's just hear the world differently.
Hear the world differently.
Yeah. So there's not a lot in that that's going to change. You don't have any of the O sounds that you'd want for northern, or you don't have the U sound like love and trust and once. But it's those are the key sort of sounds.
ABC slogan, you'll love it.
So, yeah, great. So you'll love it.
You'll love it.
Yeah, great. So we're taking the uh vowel in love and we're making that an sound. So
and I'm trying to get that
you'll
elegant.
Love it.
You'll love it.
Yeah, love it.
Love it.
Yeah, you'll great. And it's great that you picked that up, because that is part of a lot of English accents, that where we would do what's called a schwa at the end of that, we'd say you'll love it, where we use that sound which is called a choix.
We do it all the time.
Yeah. Oh, the choix. Don't even get me started. That's a whole it's a whole series of programs.
We're choix crazy in Australia.
We're choix-tastic. Mm. So they would say, you'll love it.
Love it.
Yeah, great.
So where finding that, it is hard.
Yeah, well, because we're not used to it. And the other thing about that choix change is that we do it in places that are unstressed.
Yeah.
So we're doing it when we're trying to get out of a word or not feeling like we're connected to a word. But here it's actually something you have to pay attention to because you're wanting to change it. So when you do, and that's going to happen in RP as well, you'll love it. You'll love it. Or if you're going for lunch, you'll love it. You'll love it. It's the same thing. So you've got that pattern in a lot of English accents and you just start to apply the pattern to the text.
We've got to stop, but I'll tell you a schwa story. My wife Hannah and I were in Spain some time ago and we needed a doctor.
Mm.
So I said to the guy where we were staying, can you tell me where we'd find a doctor? He said, doctor? What is doctor? I said, doctor, you know, doctor when you're sick. No, not doctor, doctor, doctor. As if I couldn't speak English. I thought, that's my Australian accent, doctor.
Love it.
Oh, love it.
I love it.
Leith McPherson, thank you for teaching us about accents.
My pleasure.
And Leith McPherson is a leading voice coach and dialect coach, and that's the first of a series which Leith made for us, teaching us how to use or how to create a series of really useful accents. They're lots of fun. You'll find the entire series on our website. On RN Summer, this is The Hub. I'm Michael Cathcart. Isn't this glorious? There's nothing like a children's choir singing really well. Every year, Opera Australia goes on a regional tour and takes on the massive task of training a local children's choir at every stop on the way. And in the past, children have performed in Mozart's Magic Flute. We just heard a piece from that opera. This year and next, they're participating in Madam Butterfly. In the Victorian city of Bendigo, ABC reporter Mark Carney meets the local choir and its chorus master.
That voice you can hear belongs to Josh Van Conklenburg, Opera Australia's regional chorus master. He's taking 20 Bendigo School students through their second last rehearsal before they join Opera Australia's touring production of Madam Butterfly. The national company has recruited a brand new children's chorus in every one of the show's 27 stops around regional Australia.
I travel around Australia with the company, but a week ahead of the production itself, and I help the children get ready for the performance. So I just polish off the work that they've been doing on the way. We start the process in April. We bring the chorus leaders to Melbourne or Sydney, or next year we bring them to Brisbane or to Perth, and show them how we'd like the music, give them some tools to help teach the kids. The students are singing as cousins of Butterfly, and so they come on in the wedding scene early on. And they're also on stage without singing in the overture. Then they join in the humming chorus. We've made a special arrangement for the kids to sing. It's notoriously difficult, but the kids' part is quite possible, and so they join in with that too.
Think you'll mind me saying, but you're very firm with the group. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
It definitely is at the third hour of the rehearsal. I try to keep it light with humour along the way, but I kind of feel you are the one that has to hold the kids' concentration, and by the end, at the beginning of the rehearsal, it's quite easy because they're getting to know you and you're in the space where you're telling them what behaviour is okay and isn't. And the middle is, it sort of starts being more problematic. And at the end, of course, by the time they're tired, they're actually starting to contravene the parameters you set. And that's when you sort of say, no, we agreed on this. No. So, yes, but they did a remarkable job and no tears.
The tough love approach hasn't turned off 11-year-old Ava Bonzi.
Rehearsal was pretty cool. It went for a little while, but it was, yeah, it was really cool. It's kind of hard to concentrate, like, after the second and a half hour or something, and then the half hour you just got to get through. Josh, he's really cool, and he knows what he's doing a lot. Yeah, so basically what he does is it's kind of different. Instead of working on the things that we need to work on right in the middle of the song, what we'll do is we'll work on it after the song and work on it for a long time until we get it right, until instead of redoing the song over and over again until we get it right, which is quite different. And we got a 15-minute break, which was just, like, incredible.
Always a bonus. Yes. Was there one thing tonight that was most difficult or the toughest thing to nail?
Our humming chorus was pretty hard because we had to master the breathing and know when to breathe exactly in each song and when not to. And we had to do a lot of staggered breathing, which is cool.
At school, do you have school choirs or music lessons?
Well, we used to have a school choir, and then because our music teacher left, it was shut down. But I'm in a choir, the Bendigo Youth Choir, and basically we rehearse pieces and things like that, which is why I'm at this performance, because I'm part of the choir, which is good.
Tell us what you know about the story of Madame Butterfly.
I know that this story was basically about how Madame Butterfly fell in love with a guy who came to Japan. And, yeah, that's all I know.
Do you know how it ends?
I actually have no idea. I hadn't heard of Madame Butterfly until I started the performance. Yeah.
How would you describe the style of music? Have you heard opera before?
Yeah. It's quite, like I said, quite full on, and it's quite, I quite like opera.
Bendigo chorus leader Gail Godber has been working with this young bunch for 3 months now, and she says they know only a smoke and mirrors version of Cho-Cho-San's ill-fated marriage to Naval Officer Pinkerton. She says opera is a new genre for most of the choristers.
There might be a member of the family who they know likes opera or likes that kind of singing. For a lot of them, you know, it's music on the contemporary music on the radio, and this is new, but no one has withdrawn from the process. They were in from the beginning, which I think is extraordinary, to get the 20 participants. We were filled to capacity. We had to disappoint a couple of young people, which was very difficult, but no one has withdrawn because they understand the opportunity. It's about the opportunity to participate with these incredible singers. So the participants won't be on stage for the entire opera, so we'll be able to watch while we're backstage. But I think the dramatic, the cutting edge of the story won't be felt so harshly by the children. It's more about being surrounded by the beautiful music of Puccini. Yeah,
absolutely. What can you say is the experience for these young people to perform alongside some of the country's best?
It's very difficult to prepare children for that experience, for being in a theatre that is packed to capacity, standing beside and among, having these magnificent voices all around you with incredible musicians playing for you. They asked me on Wednesday whether I was going to be playing the piano for the opera, so that will give you the impression that that it's hard to prepare them for what they're about to experience.
Not all the singers are nervous, though. In fact, this next young singer has told me he's ready and raring to go for the big night.
I am Joshua Joel Singer, and I am 12.
Joshua, that is a perfect name for someone who's going to be performing on stage with Opera Australia Scene. Do people tell you that all the time, that you've got the perfect surname?
Yes, I sing a lot. I've always sung since I was tiny.
And why do you like singing?
I don't know. It's just how, when I was little, I just, all the rest of my family has all been very musical, so.
Hey, when we think of opera performers, often they're big stars. Maybe they have a lot of experience. Is that at all intimidating for someone as young as yourself?
Not really.
Why not? Why are you so confident?
Oh, because it's just fun and you get to know other people and you get very confident with your voice very quickly.
It's that youthful confidence that Josh Van Conklenburg says makes children a willing and able group to work with.
Kids learn and respond on the whole with much more immediacy than adults do. Adults have very stylized, learnt ways of responding. Kids respond much more naturally. And that can be a real blessing, especially when you're teaching. The new performers at every port actually keeps the production fresh for the professionals. They have to respond in a new way, always a slightly different balance of looking after them on stage, making sure that their singing is fine.
What do you make of that old adage, never work with children or animals on stage?
You were talking about the focus before, how I'm quite strict. I make a point of treating the children in the same way that I would treat adult colleagues. And I lay down at the beginning exactly what I expect from them. And when they don't work in that way, I let them know that they're not. And in the same way with adults, you lay down the lines. It's just with adults, you call them contracts. So I haven't had to train animals yet.
That's it. Now we're going to sing it in Puccini. 1, 2, 3.
Chorus master Josh Van Conklenburg taking you behind the scenes of Opera Australia's regional children's chorus program. And that tour of Madame Butterfly will continue next year with 20 dates scheduled across the country in July and in August. That means that 20 more children's choruses will be trained. And you'll find a link to all those dates on our website. Just visit The Hub on Stage. ABC reporter Mark Carney with that story. And that's it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed revisiting some of our favourite stories for the year. Thanks as always to our producer, Kim Jurek. Executive producer of The Hub is Rhiannon Brown, and technical wizardry today is by Kerry Dell. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Let's talk again soon. Bye now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.